Thank you so much for those beautiful words and for such a rich introduction to myself. And thank you also to the Institute and Ferdinand specifically for inviting me here. It's such an honor to meet you all and to discover this sister organization more at depth that has done work on social ecology since 30 years. At the Stockholm Resilience Center, we only started in 2007. So we have lots to learn, I'm sure. And it's also great to know that in this room we have people from many different disciplines and backgrounds and so on, and we have students and professors and everything in between. But I think if there's one thing that we all share in this room and beyond, it is the need to secure our only home in the universe, of course, the biosphere. And that's what we picture here. As you know, it's a 20-kilometer thin layer around planet Earth, where actually life creates the conditions conducive to life. And at the Stockholm Resilience Center, we bring together scientists from the natural sciences and the social sciences, together with change makers from municipalities, businesses, associations, local communities around the world, to understand how humans can become better stewards of the biosphere. Because of course, you know, we're in this new situation now as a species where we have really fundamentally altered those conditions conducive to life, including the conditions for our own life. Yet we're still totally dependent on the biosphere to continue supporting us. So we want to understand the situation so that we can navigate towards a future that includes people in the biosphere, because I'm sure that the biosphere will continue no matter what we do. But it would be nice to be part of it. So in this talk, I will focus on a particular aspect of the challenge, which is how to bring insights from ecology, which is of course the study of how living organisms, including humans, interact with one another and with their physical environment, bringing those insights into decision making at a time where most people actually live quite disconnected from other life forms in urban areas. But first, I wanted to just give a backstory to set the scene. I am an ecologist by training, a systems ecologist, and for my degree project, I did this study of the habitat preferences of penne shrimp, this giant shrimp that we eat when we eat sushi, for example. And the underlying reason for this study was actually that I wanted to inform decision making around mangrove forest management in Mozambique. Because back then, this was the late 1990s, mangroves had been cut all over the world to provide shrimp farming, areas for shrimp farming, in spite of their massive importance when it comes to storm protection, for example, and nutrient retention, nursery for a large number of species. But here in Inyaka Island, the forest remained intact, and wild-caught shrimp were a very important income for Mozambique. And of course, they had their larvae stage in the mangroves, but where in the mangrove forest was what I wanted to understand. So I spent 3 months here putting up stake nets and counting and so on, doing statistics. And with me, I had another student who had the task of setting up a query experiment, like you do in ecology, with predators in terms of which were fish and then shrimp, and then different conditions like different numbers of roots and different kinds of water, turbidity and so on, to see what kind of mangrove forest does the penne shrimp need to be protected. For that he needed live fish, and he spent weeks trying to catch live fish of a particular species and size without hurting them, so that they could go into the aquarium experiment. And he failed miserably. And then in desperation, he turned to a group of kids who had been following us around all along, you know, very curious about what we were doing, and just asked, can you please help me catch live fish? Off they went, they came back a few hours later with a bucket full of fish, perfect size, perfect species, alive and kicking. And that's when I realized you know, what if these people actually know pretty well where in the forest we can find the penny tree, and maybe even why? And what am I doing here as an ecologist, going here, doing all of these, you know, big studies and publishing that? And eventually, the paper was published, and I can pretty much assure you that at least that publication didn't make a difference for the decision makers in Mozambique. So I realized that actually I needed some other kind of approach if I wanted my ecology to inform decision making. And in this talk, I will just give three examples. Of course, there are myriads of ways in which ecology actually reached decision making. But I wanted to talk about three that I've been involved with since then. The first one is these more conventional scientific assessments like IPBES or the IPCC. The second one is adaptive co-management and adaptive governance, which I have studied a lot in the biosphere reserves. And the third one is quite a recent approach that we call Keystone Actor Dialogues that have been developed by my colleague Henrik Österblom and others. And I think they're interesting because they provide some similarities and some contrasts. So how many of you already know about this assessment? Please raise a hand. Yeah, quite a few, but not everyone. It's the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, and it assesses existing knowledge for policymakers. Their global assessment drew on 15,000 sources, and it was a multi-year process that involved several hundreds of scientists. And the report was then adopted by policymakers from 140 member states in 2019. And some of the high-level messages that came from this report after this massive effort was that 1 million species are threatened with extinction. That there are five key drivers behind this loss of biodiversity, that are the changes in land and sea use, the direct exploitation of organisms, climate change, pollution, and invasive alien species. And this is, of course, very useful information to decision makers who want to halt the loss of biodiversity. They also stated how influential people are, but that indigenous peoples have been able to maintain biodiversity better. They constructed some policy scenarios and concluded that we need transformative change, just as we heard before. They also connected nature to people's well-being and showed that these negative trends undermine the sustainable development goals. And we can see some signs that policymakers listened. Here, a few years later, in the Convention on Biodiversity, there was a global agreement to protect 30% and restore 30% by 2030, so addressing that thing of land use. We can also see that they would prevent over-harvesting, reduce pollution of nutrients and pesticides and plastics. And also, I think this final thing was interesting, that they actually said that large and transnational companies and financial institutions should be required to monitor and assess and disclose their risks, dependencies, and also impacts on biodiversity throughout their whole operations. But of course, we also know from the example of climate change that international agreements are not always resulting in action on the ground. And this is a graph of the annual carbon dioxide emissions, and we can see where we cannot see, but I can tell you that the first IPCC assessment report was published in 1990, and we adopted the Paris Agreement in 2015, but global emissions keep rising, except for when we have an economic crisis or a pandemic, then we have lower emissions for a while, but then they come back. So, in other words, this model of decision making and idea that you would have some ecology insights going into the central policymaker who would then translate that into implementation monitoring at the regional scale, which would lead to some kind of behavioral response among people, is obviously incomplete. Decision-making happens at all levels. It's informed not only, of course, by ecological knowledge, but also by the norms and rules, the habits and convenience, availability of options, and so on. And ecological knowledge, as I said before, also exists outside academia, like among indigenous groups, local resources, and inhabitants. And all of this is happening in a world that is changing all the time, making it very difficult to rely on these scientific assessments only for timely insights. So then that brings me to the other approach to bring ecology into decision making, which is this, what we call adaptive co-management. And a really rich example of this comes from the Kristianstads vattenrike in southern Sweden that I studied for my PhD work as part of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. So adaptive refers to the focus on continuous change in the ecosystem and the attention to that, the experimentation and the learning that combines local and scientific knowledge. And the co-management refers to the flexible collaboration that you see pictured here that involves decision makers at different levels and working at different parts of the landscape and in different sectors. In this case, it actually emerges from a crisis that was perceived in the late 1980s in these large wetland areas, where there was deteriorating water quality because there had been a garbage dump established on this land. There was a decreased grazing, and this is cultural landscape that depends on the grazing. There was a loss of habitat for both the birds and the plants and the insects here. And people tried to notify the municipality and the county board and saying that we needed to protect this area, but nothing really helped until some people realized that they needed to develop some kind of vision for this place that included people and nature. And they came up with this idea of establishing a water realm, a vattenrike, where people could really come together, restore these areas to the benefit of plants and birds, but also to all the people living here. Because of course these wetlands function as big swamps that protect the city from flooding, and it functions as, it cleans the water that goes out into the Baltic and so on, but no one had until then really showed the values to people. But some people came together, managed to get some funding, started restoring areas together with farmers, and then also started the nature school where people could come out and see the area, and eco museum and so on. And in 2005, it was designated a biosphere reserve by UNESCO. And we can see the environmental minister at the time in this picture, and also Sven-Erik Magnusson, who was the key individual behind this area. And since then, we've seen six other biosphere reserves emerge in Sweden, inspired by this approach of adaptive co-management. It's funny, when we came back and told them in this area what they were doing was adaptive co-management, they just looked at us and said, well, yeah, you can say that, or you can just say common sense. Like, we collaborate, we bring in together knowledge, we try to adapt to the situation and so on. But still, it's quite a rare approach actually in today's society where we do a lot of things in silos, and with quite rigid approaches. So I would say that it still deserves its own term. After this study, which was just one case, quite small, we did a comparison with two other bigger cases that had similar approaches, this adaptive governance approach, and looked at how they had actually emerged. One was the initiative to curb illegal fisheries in the Southern Ocean through a collaboration between environmental NGOs, governments, and also the legal fishermen who wanted the illegal fishery to end. The other one was the work to rezone the Great Barrier Reef based on consultation with local users, indigenous peoples, and scientists. And in contrast to the scientific assessment process that I described earlier, the ecological knowledge used in this case, these cases, is context-specific. It's brought in not only by scientists, but by local resource users. And in addition, it doesn't come once every 5 or 6 years, but in the continuous work of planning, experimenting, monitoring, and evaluating. But then the question can emerge, you know, does this work elsewhere? We still only have 3 cases. So then we did a study looking into experiences in 146 biosphere reserves. So we asked questions about their governance, who is involved and how do they work with learning and knowledge. And then we also asked questions about how well they're doing. So are they able to make decisions that contribute to biodiversity conservation and sustainable development, which are the goals of biosphere reserves. And we can see here that the more adaptive co-management scores you got, the more likely you were to both be able to conserve biodiversity and support economic development and social development. So it's not the only approach to work, but at least it's not making things worse, in spite of it being very time consuming. So that brings me soon to the Keystone Dialogues, which is my third example. Because of course ecosystems are not only affected by decisions in an actual place or actual landscape. We're a very globalized society where decisions that we make in this room as consumers affect ecosystems across the world. And we can just, for example, think about the breakfast we had this morning and all of the ecosystems and people that helped bring that food to our plate to realize this fact. And this image shows roads, railways, air routes, and shipping that bring goods and people around the planet, just to show how connected we are. So then one can wonder, how can signals from an ecosystem be brought into decision-making of actors that shape that ecosystem from very far away? And this is where we have, at the Stockholm Resilience Center, experimented with something that we call Keystone Dialogues. It all started with a study of transnational corporations as keystone actors in marine ecosystems. And this idea was inspired by the concept of keystone species. It's an organism that has a profound effect on ecosystems. And the study identified 10 seafood companies that dominate global production revenues and volumes, that connect ecosystems globally through their subsidiaries, and who influence global governance processes and institutions. So their decisions really matter to the ecology of the ocean, but also the ecology of the ocean should really matter to them. And the first dialogue was held with 8 CEOs in 2016. We brought in ecology through these background briefs on the science, but also in face-to-face interactions, of course, with these people and the interactions between scientists and business leaders. The first dialogue resulted in 10 commitments towards ocean stewardship and also a shared initiative to meet those commitments. And since then we've held a series of dialogues continuously supported by science and ecology. We've also seen some decisions being made, mostly related to data collecting and reporting, but also related to eliminating illegal fishery and even slavery that still exists in this kind of industry. And I often say when I describe this case that the ocean itself hasn't actually discovered, I think, that this initiative exists, because it still hasn't really changed how they fish or where or so. It takes a long time to mobilize a big company and shift norms, but it is an important start to start the dialogue and do the inventories and all of that. And you can see the many years that we have spent on this process and how we're now beginning to see some very positive signs. So inspired by this, I started wondering if you could possibly condense this process to engage more business leaders, because of course the private sector has a very large influence on the biosphere. And after some thinking together with friends and also colleagues, we came up with this idea to create an executive program in resilience thinking. It's tailored to CEOs and chairpersons of influential companies. And they're not then in the same industry, but they're from very many different industries. And we bring them together 3 times. First, a half day focusing on the actual situation we're in, laying the ground on the science around where we're at. The second meetup is actually a 3-day retreat where they focus more on what can be done about the situation and what is each and everyone's roles in the path to a more positive future. And then they leave that retreat with a commitment to something that they are going to try out and do. And then the third meetup is them sharing what they've done. And that creates some nice competition also among the CEOs who want to show something really strong that they've done, but it's also an important learning opportunity to actually act on some of the insights. It's funded by participant fees, so it's a commissioned education program where we cannot make a profit but also not subsidize their participation. And the ambition here is to really support learning and collaboration to accelerate sustainability transformations. And these are some of the speakers that are in the program. Many of them with a background in ecology, but of course not everyone. So how has this then gone? I mean, when I launched the idea, lots of people told me that you will never get CEOs of big companies to spend 5 days with scientists. Maybe you can condense it into a lunch seminar and you can send the sustainability manager to do the full thing. But I really felt that this needs to be understood at the very top level of decision making. It needs to be part of the core of the company strategy if there is going to be a difference. The sustainability manager knows most of this already, but the sustainability manager needs a very strong champion at the top who sees that this is a key to the survival of the business in the future. So actually since then we have been able to bring in 15, 16 people a year. In total 90 participants have contributed or been part of this. They represent millions of customers and employees. Their revenue together, combined revenue, is many times that of Sweden, or about half of that of Sweden as a whole, but their climate impact, for example, the emissions of greenhouse gases from these companies are several times that of Sweden because they have their multinationals. So I think what these CEOs and companies decide to do and how they act in the biosphere will shape the conditions for many, many of us. Just want to make sure that we have some time for questions and so on. So what time is it? I don't have it here. We have time? Yeah, it's okay. Because I wanted actually to go a bit deeper here, because I think this is where I've at least learned most about how you can connect the ecology and the insights that we have from science to actual decision making. And when I came across this book and looked into, you know, Hindsight, how we've actually done the program, I realized that we've actually worked quite a lot to get across these barriers that exist towards like this, in this case, climate science, but I think we can see the same barriers towards ecology. Have you seen this book before? Per Espen Stoknes. He's an environmental psychologist, and he was interested in what is it that makes people not act in the climate space, in spite of all of the information that we have, like the IPCC reports. He talks about these five barriers, where the first one is distance. Climate change happens elsewhere. Our actions make no difference, those two things. So I'm distant both to the effects and also what I can do about it. Doom, the challenge is way too overwhelming, seems impossible to address. Dissonance, it's when we cannot act in line with our ethics. So like when we fly to a conference, even though we know the train is the better option, and that creates a dissonance. Denial is a defense mechanism to cope with the feelings of doom and dissonance. And then identity is the final barrier, which is about feeling that climate action is not for people like me, it's for people like Greta Thunberg, for example. So to address distance then, we work quite hard to show that there are consequences here and now of the biodiversity crisis and the climate crisis. And this has, of course, become unfortunately easier over the years because we now have these impacts here, and all of the companies have this, you know, experienced this in their supply chain. So they can see that already now there are consequences of our bad management of the biosphere. But also to show how influential they are, that 157 of the top 200 economic entities by revenue are corporations, not countries. So they also have to get on board, and they cannot only wait for politicians to set the rules and start actually rebuilding the systems that they depend on. To assess doom, we need to convey the message, which we have support from in many studies, that it is not too late, it's sort of never too late, the sooner we act the better, but also that we know what it takes, and it takes deep transformation. We know what it takes. It is possible to meet people's needs within the capacity of the planet. We can maybe not meet the greed of all people on the planet, but at least all needs. And this is what we need to do. We try to summarize it like this. Of course, moving from fossil fuels to renewable energy, from a linear to a circular economy, and then from the exploitation that we've seen so far of ecosystems and societies to regeneration. We also work hard to bring ecology to the center of this picture, and since many of them are very focused on climate change, because that's where corporate action has been, we show them this picture, just showing where does greenhouse gas emissions come from. And of course it's the burning of fossil fuels here and some production of cement, but also from our land use. And where have they ended up? Well, of course in the atmosphere, where we can see the warming happening as a result of that, but also they have been absorbed by the ocean and the land sink. So this means that we need to start collaborating with the biosphere if we are going to also combat climate change. And here I think the planetary boundaries that we have developed at the Stockholm Resilience Centre as a concept is important to provide this diagnosis of what is it that would be a safe operating space for humanity? What are the key processes that we need to really address if we are going to maintain conditions on the planet suitable for human civilizations? We talk also quite a lot about the pace of change. Again, actually, not as a doom thing, but an innovation agenda for them, that it's about halving emissions every decade, following what we call the carbon law, inspired by the Moore's law for innovation, which is something that many of them recognize, where computers increase their power exponentially. And we're thinking that the first halving of emissions should be quite easy to do within 10 years, and then in the meantime, we can develop the solutions for the second halving. We show them that there are existing solutions for the first halving that, if scaled up, would actually help us maintain the services that we need, but with half emissions in 10 years. In these different sectors, the energy supply, industry, buildings, transport, nature-based sinks and sources, and even food production and consumption. Of course, no one has looked into what happens if we scale up all of this at the same time in terms of material use and so on, but it's still an eye-opener for them that actually we don't need to wait for technology, we can actually work with the technology that we have now. Addressing denial, I think, is very much about including people in the dialogue and co-producing knowledge together. And I would say that we do this in the executive program as well, even though it's a training program where science is at the core. We also bring in their knowledge about their industries and what they're doing and how they can make sense of this. So I think that is a key to get away from this denial, that you're actually an active participant in this. And then finally, addressing identity, this fact that it's not only people like Greta Thunberg who can act on the climate, there are also leaders within industry who are stepping forward and set their targets for the climate in line with the Paris Agreement and so on. And they do this because it makes sense in their business logic to do this. We show them these figures of every year there are new companies joining this initiative. And showing also policy that actually there is a need and the potential for ambitious climate policy. And here maybe you've also seen that the first science-based targets for nature have just been released following this initiative that was focused on the greenhouse gas emissions and the climate. The final thing that I want to say is that we know also from our work on social ecological transformation that they never happen just from the top. You can never steer transformation from the top or direct it or control it. But we can open up the top leadership for transformation, and then we also need to work on mobilizing society broadly. And there we've done, since the last year, we've also done the same kind of training, but for all union, trade union leaders in Sweden. And together they represent 3.5 million Swedes who in their everyday work could potentially contribute to a sustainability transformation if they found a vehicle to do that. It was interesting when we invited Johan Rockström and Kate Rayworth to contribute as speakers into this program. They both immediately committed to coming to Stockholm because they had never trained union leaders before. And it's so important, I think, to help unions see how they can be a positive force in shaping the climate transition so that it is just and it's doing good for people's jobs and well-being, and it provides security in this transition. Because I think today many people are more afraid of the transition than of climate change itself. And there I think we can work with these civil society organizations who are experts in group work, experts in collaboration, experts in listening in and providing room for different voices in shaping the path forward. So this is something we will continue doing until we've actually trained all the union leaders in Sweden, so we will do it once more, and then I'm hoping that this model could potentially be useful in other countries as well. Of course, it's part of the story that in Sweden we have a history of unions and employers coming together when there are big transitions and agreeing on ways forward in a coordinated manner. And this has been done since the early 1900s, when there was lots of conflicts and strikes, which were detrimental to everyone. So then they decided to sit down and talk it through instead. It's called Saltsjöbadsandan. So we're drawing on that also for the climate transition. Some keys to success. I think you've seen these statements that scientific assessments, of course, need to be credible and salient, legitimate. That's true also for the other two approaches that I talked about. We can see that for adaptive co-management, you need a shared vision, trust building, engagement, and support from institutions. I've also found that you actually need a bridging organization, someone who is responsible for the collaboration itself, that holds this vision and this network and keeps the momentum going. The Keystone Dialogues and the executive programs are still in an experimental phase, I would say, but it seems that they have similar requirements as the adaptive co-management, that it's a matter of the quality of the process that people are in, but also the content, and when you have that combination, you can actually bring equality into decision-making. So I think when summarizing this, it becomes common sense again. And I think we are like that. We make the whole wheel and then we come back to the same place where we started, but maybe with a deeper understanding. It's important to consider whose decision is it that matters for this issue? Who do you need to reach? What information actually matters to those decisions? And how can you bring that information to the decision makers' attention in a way that works for them? So it's about the language, it's about the format, it's about who else you have in the room, and so on. And with that, I'd like to thank you so much for your attention, and I look forward to any comments, reflections, questions you may have.